be along quickly. I am so much fatigued that I cannot ride all night by the mail, but I will be with you on Wednesday about 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Not a moment was to be wasted. On the 4th of July, Federalists made a point of appearing at Jefferson's annual levee. A newspaper reported that the President's foes mingled with perfect cordiality with their Republican brethren. At a dinner at Steele's, there were patriotic toasts. The American people, ready at a moment's warning to vindicate the rights and avenge the wrongs of their country, was one. Another guest rose and said, "The President of the United States, the hand that drafted the Declaration of Independence, will maintain inviolate the principles it recognizes." Jefferson grasped the import of the moment, issuing a proclamation banning armed British ships from U.S. waters. At a cabinet meeting, he decided to call on the governors of the states to have their quotas of 100,000 militiamen ready, and he ordered the purchase of arms, ammunition, and supplies. The president gave the order unilaterally, without congressional approval. He believed he was the best judge of what was needed in the present crisis. "The moment our peace was threatened, I deemed it indispensable to secure a greater provision of those articles of military stores with which our magazines were not sufficiently furnished," Jefferson told Congress after the fact. "I trust that the legislature, feeling the same anxiety for the safety of our country, so materially advanced by this precaution, will approve, when done, what they would have seen so important to be done if then assembled." Congress agreed. The presidency was further strengthened, and Jefferson's view of power affirmed. A strict observance of the written laws is doubtless one of the high duties of a good citizen, but it is not the highest, he wrote after he left office. "The laws of necessity, of self-preservation, of saving our country when in danger, are of higher obligation. To lose our country by a scrupulous adherence to written law would be to lose the law itself, with life, liberty, property, and all those who are enjoying them with us, thus absurdly sacrificing the end to the means." A ship, the USS Revenge, was dispatched to England to receive an answer from the British government about the Leopard's attack. Outrage came upon outrage. A revenue cutter was also fired upon. Its most prominent passenger, Vice President George Clinton, later told Jefferson that the emotion generated by the British depredations was unsettling even the most extreme of Federalists. "To the Tories or British Federalists," Clinton said, "this is a mortifying circumstance, as they cannot but perceive that in case of war they will be deserted by their electioneering allies and left to shift for themselves." Anti-British feeling was certainly acute. "The spirit and enterprise of the American character are peculiarly fit for offensive enterprises," the journalist William Duane wrote Jefferson on Wednesday, July 8th. He proposed a 4-point attack on the British as an offensive move in the wake of the Chesapeake. Duane's suggestions: strike Canada, capture Halifax, and invade Newfoundland and Jamaica. Jefferson planned to call Congress for October 1807. "Reason and the usage of civilized nations require that we should give them an opportunity of disavowal and reparation," Jefferson wrote to John Wales Epps on Sunday, July 12th. "Our own interest, too, the very means of making war, requires that we should give time to our merchants to gather in their vessels and property and our seamen now afloat." Jefferson's openness to war was evident from the beginning of the crisis. "Reparation for the past and security for the future is our motto, but whether the English will yield it freely or will require resort to non-intercourse or to war is yet to be seen," he said. "We prepare for the last." On the final day of July 1807, he called for the October special session of Congress. Worried about remaining fully informed during a visit to Monticello, he increased the mail service from Washington to Monticello, where he was to spend the latter part of the summer. Despite the war fever in the first hours of the Chesapeake crisis, Jefferson had guessed that lawmakers would be more inclined to impose an embargo than to go immediately to war. He was not lost in a philosophic experiment in pacifism. He was willing to fight, but he believed Congress would prefer an embargo first. Differing Jeffersonian impulses were in conflict. His fear of the threat large military establishments posed to republics was predominant at the moment. Yet he was also being practical. He knew America could not build a navy to compete with Britain's soon enough to make a difference in the struggle at hand. His experience of the past 2 decades in foreign policy had also taught him that time often resolved the issues of the hour. From Nootka Sound to Saint-Domingue, shifting strategic concerns abroad, the fall of a government in London, the decision of an emperor in Paris, the outcome of a battle in a far-off place, could settle or complicate the problems facing the United States. At dinner one day in November 1807 at the President's House, David Montagu Erskine, the new British minister, was sitting with Jefferson, Augustus Foster, the poet-diplomat Joel Barlow, and Louisa Catherine and John Quincy Adams. There were reports that London might transfer the negotiations over the maritime issues to Washington. If true, Jefferson said to Erskine, I suppose this will take us all winter, and in the meantime your nation will make peace and leave us nothing to dispute about. That is all my hope. Recording the incident in his diary, John Quincy Adams wrote, If there was any sincerity in these words, procrastination includes the whole compass of Mr. Jefferson's policy, which I believe to be really the case. The question of the moment, Jefferson told Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. on Monday, November 30th, was whether war, embargo, or nothing shall be the course. The middle proposition is most likely. But that was not to be the only American response. In the meantime, Jefferson said, there is a disposition, one, to vote a sufficient number of gunboats, two, a sufficient sum, $750,000, for defensive works, three, to classify the militia, four, to establish a naval militia, five, to give a bounty in lands in Orleans on the west side of the river for a strong settlement of Americans as a militia. An embargo was a means, not an end. The members, as far as I can judge, are extremely disposed for peace, and as there is no doubt Great Britain will disavow the act of the leopard, I am inclined to believe they will be more disposed to combat her practice of impressment by a non-importation law than by arms, he had written Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. on Monday, October 26th. In December 1807, news from Paris and London roiled the already unsettled American capital. Napoleon announced he was extending the Berlin Decree banning British imports to all nations, including the United States. George III, far from making concessions on the impressment question, ordered British vessels to seize British subjects from merchant and warships. Informing Congress that two of the world's great powers were increasing the pressure on American interests, Jefferson proposed that the United States order its own ships to remain in port in the United States, while making every preparation for whatever events may grow out of the present crisis. What came next? Politically, war seemed impossible at the moment. The emotional intensity that had grown out of the Chesapeake affair in summer had faded. The war fever is past, Jefferson wrote Patsy in November. For now, the answer was embargo. It was far from ideal, and Albert Gallatin articulated its inherent flaws best. In every point of view, privations, sufferings, revenue, effect on the enemy, politics at home, etc., I prefer war to a permanent embargo, Gallatin told Jefferson on Friday, December 18th. Moreover, governmental prohibitions do always more mischief than had been calculated, and it is not without much hesitation that a statesman should hazard to regulate the concerns of individuals as if he could do it better than themselves. In principle, Jefferson agreed. In practice, he was torn. What is good in this case cannot be effected, he wrote Gallatin. We have, therefore, only to find out what will be least bad. Jefferson was guided in part by Republican ideology. The end of war and the reign of reason was a dream of the age. War led to monarchy and aristocracy and evils that tended to destroy the liberty of the many while empowering the few. Yet Jefferson was no pacific purist. He had waged war in the Mediterranean, and he was willing to wage it against Britain and possibly against France. But not yet. His calculation, one ratified by Congress, was that time was America's ally. The embargo, keeping at home our vessels, cargoes, and seamen, saves us the necessity of making their capture the cause of immediate war. For, if going to England, France had determined to take them. If to any other place, England was to take them, Jefferson wrote John Taylor. This gives time. Time may produce peace in Europe. Peace in Europe removes all causes of differences till another European war, and by that time our debt may be paid, our revenues clear, and our strength increased. The legislation had passed quickly, and Jefferson signed the embargo on Tuesday, December 22, 1807. It was a breathtaking bill, a projection of governmental power that surpassed even the hated Alien and Sedition Acts. After signing it, Jefferson was struck by a toothache, which brought on a very large and hard swelling of the face, and that produced a fever, which left me last night, he wrote Patsy on Tuesday, December 29th. He felt the burdens of office as never before. The pain in his jaw compounded the stress he was feeling. For all intents and purposes, he was expanding federal power into every part of the economic life of every American. Trade with foreign nations was forbidden. Nothing could come into the country. Nothing could go out. A subsequent enforcement act gave Jefferson himself power over shipping. He was accustomed to wielding the weapons of economic war. Non-importation with targeted countries, for instance, had been part of his life since Williamsburg. He believed in, and had long practiced, commercial diplomacy. The Republican dream of a war-free world of open markets had proved unrealizable, which led Jefferson to adapt his principles to the realities that confronted the United States. Economic coercion was a widely accepted means of foreign policy. The totality of an embargo was related, but different. It was viewed as a limited means of securing time to prepare for war, or to let the threat of war pass. As the American experience would show, embargoes were impractical over the long term. Jefferson understood that the nation was commercial as well as agrarian, and that his duty extended to the whole country. Our people have a decided taste for navigation and commerce, he said. They take this from their mother country, and their servants are in duty bound to calculate all their measures on this datum. In the beginning, the country was willing to trust Jefferson's course. Confidence now seems to be in Mr. Jefferson's hands, as effectual in producing a compliance with his recommendations as soldiers in the hands of Bonaparte in procuring submission to his commands, Timothy Pickering wrote on Monday, January 18, 1808. Passage of the embargo, he said, was the result of the public's implicit, blind confidence in the president. Our embargo, which has been a very trying measure, has produced one very happy and permanent effect, Jefferson wrote Lafayette. It has set us all on domestic manufacture, and will, I verily believe, reduce our future demands on England fully one half. That was an overstatement, but the year-long embargo did have an effect in Britain. There were protests from merchants and manufacturers against the anti-American policy that had led to Jefferson's reprisal. In April 1808, Britain, feeling the lack of an American market, essentially invited ships to break the embargo. Smuggling was an enormous problem, particularly to the north, where illicit trade with the British in the Canadian region flourished. Jefferson warned those, combining and confederating together on Lake Champlain and the country thereto adjacent, for the purposes of forming insurrections against the authority of the laws of the United States. The executive branch was given extraordinary authority to enforce the embargo. The embargo turned American politics upside down. Jefferson became the explicit advocate of strong central power. Republicans who favored less government became the most meddlesome of regulators. Connecticut became a bastion of states' rights, asserting that in such a crisis of affairs, it is right, and has become the duty of the legislative and executive authorities in the state, to withhold their aid and cooperation from the execution of the act passed to enforce more effectually the embargo system. The embargo succeeded in the sense that it postponed war with Britain, though neither it nor any other policy finally prevented what became known as the War of 1812. The diplomat William Pinckney probably had it right when he told Madison in 1809, "Any other measure than the embargo would have been madness or cowardice, for no others were in our choice but war with both aggressors, or submission to both, with the certainty, too, that that submission would in its progress either lead to war or to a state of abject degradation." The embargo was not out of character for Jefferson. In the broadest sense, it put him in control, but somewhat at a remove, and it avoided immediate conflict with the European powers. Like the Louisiana Purchase, which was, to say the very least, vastly more successful, the embargo illustrated Jefferson's flexibility and capacity to adapt his professed ideology to present realities. "The embargo is salutary," Jefferson wrote Benjamin Rush in January 1808. "It postpones war, gives time and the benefit of events which that may produce, particularly that of peace in Europe, which will postpone the causes of difference to the next war." History has not been kind to Jefferson's embargo. It is commonly seen as bad policy that delayed but did not prevent war and left America weaker. There is much to this criticism, but the options Jefferson had were such that the embargo, as he himself put it, may not have been a good idea, but it was the least bad. The country was not ready for war with Britain or with France, either politically or militarily, and the politics of the moment worked against attempts to strengthen the army and the navy. Prevailing opinion held that standing armies were bad, and that naval establishments were invitations to, rather than defenses against, war, as well as incredibly expensive. These were Jefferson's opinions, too, in the abstract, but he had proved adept at adapting his convictions. He did ask Congress for measures that would have strengthened the nation's defenses, at least somewhat. Congress resisted, or moved slowly, and that was that. Neither Jefferson nor the national leadership of the first decade or so of the 19th century comes off well in terms of military preparedness. The American failure to provide sufficiently for defense until war was actually upon her was a phenomenon the country would see again. Jefferson tried to convince himself the embargo was working. "I have been happy in my journey through the country to this place to find the people unanimous in their preference of the embargo to war, and the great sacrifice they make rendered a cheerful one from a sense of its necessity," Jefferson wrote for Monticello in May 1808. His own mail suggested otherwise. "You infernal villain," wrote a John Lane Jones from Boston in August. "How much longer are you going to keep this damned embargo on to starve us poor people? One of my children has already starved to death, of which I am ashamed, and declare that it died of an apoplexy. I have three more children, which I expect will starve soon if I don't get something for them to eat, which cannot be had. You are the damnedest fool that God put life into," an anonymous letter writer told Jefferson in the middle of 1808. "God damn you." Another anonymous writer wrote in June, "Thy destruction is near at hand, Thomas. The retributive sword is suspended over thy head by a slender thread. Beware." In some quarters in New England, especially in Boston, the reaction to the attack on the Chesapeake had been muted. John Quincy Adams, who was sympathetic to Jefferson in the crisis, had to convince Federalists in Boston to hold a town meeting in an open, free-hearted manner, setting aside all party feeling to support the government of their country. He succeeded, but at a price. He was told that he should have his head taken off for his apostasy to the Federalists. Talk of disunion was revived. Timothy Pickering wrote a public letter attacking the embargo and the president. In New York, villagers burned Jefferson in effigy on the 4th of July, 1808. From Boston, the Republican governor of Massachusetts, James Sullivan, was convinced that the embargo was strengthening the hands of the pro-British forces. "The attempt is to divide the nation and establish in this part of this hemisphere a different form of government under the protection of Great Britain," Sullivan wrote to Jefferson in April 1808. "You will laugh at this, and so would Southern members of Congress, but their destruction will come upon them as a whirlwind. The walls of Monticello are not impregnable to the arm of civil contest or the rapacious hand of tyranny." The Federalists had more conventional means at their disposal to show that they, not the Jeffersonians, represented the American mainstream. The presidential election of 1808. Early that year, James Madison was nominated for president by congressional caucus. Jefferson had long hoped that Madison would succeed him, but he worried about competition between Madison and James Monroe, who had also won votes in the caucus. "I see with infinite grief a contest arising between yourself and another, who have been very dear to each other and equally so to me," Jefferson wrote Monroe from Washington in February 1808. "I sincerely pray that these dispositions may not be affected between you. I know too well from experience the progress of political controversy and the exacerbation of spirit into which it degenerates, not to fear for the continuance of your mutual esteem. One peaking thing, said, draws on another, that a third, and always with increasing acrimony, until all restraint is thrown off and it becomes difficult for yourselves to keep clear of the toils in which your friends will endeavor to interlace you, and to avoid the participation in their passions which they will endeavor to produce." His delineation of the environment and the emotions of the politician was born of a lifetime of experience. The tension between social harmony and the demands of politics was not one that Jefferson or anyone else could ever resolve. It could only be managed. The election of 1808 was a referendum on Jefferson. With Madison, his closest ally, as the Republican candidate, it could be no other. The Federalists put Charles Cotesworth Pinckney forward again. The arguments against Madison were echoes of old refrains against Jefferson, that Madison favored the French and disliked the British, that Virginia had held too much power for too long, that the Republican creed inevitably led to mob rule. Nothing worked. Madison won a substantial victory, with 122 electoral votes to Pinckney's 47. Jefferson's presidency was ending as his public life had begun, amid fears of monarchy. In Congress in early January 1809, there was a movement toward ending the embargo, and, in the event of ongoing European hostilities, issuing letters of marque and reprisal, meaning private ships could act as vessels of war, attacking and capturing enemy craft. To Jefferson, writing in January, "The monarchists of the North, who have been for some time fostering the hope of separation, have federalized the five eastern states and endangered New York. The Massachusetts legislature, which is to meet the middle of this month, it is believed, will call a convention to consider the question of a separation of the Union, and to propose it to the whole country east of the North River, and they are assured of the protection of Great Britain." The enveloping fear was of British encroachment. "A line seems now to be drawing," Jefferson said, "between the really Republican Federalists and the English party, who are devoted, soul and body, to England and monarchy." Some things in Jefferson's world never changed. Chapter 39. A Farewell to Ultimate Power. Considering the extraordinary character of the times in which we live, our attention should unremittingly be fixed on the safety of our country. Thomas Jefferson in his final message to Congress. It was almost time to go. The diseased jawbone having exfoliated, the piece was extracted about a week ago, the place is healed, the swelling nearly subsided, and I wait only for moderate weather to resume my rides, Jefferson wrote Patsy in his last Washington winter. I am already sensible of decay in the power of walking, and find my memory not so faithful as it used to be, he wrote his old colleague Charles Thompson on Christmas Day, 1808. This may be partly owing to the incessant current of new matter flowing constantly through it, but I ascribe to years their share in it also. He had been at this for so long. As he inventoried the furniture in the president's house and thought about how to pay his bills, he estimated he was $8,000 to $10,000 more in debt from his years as president, he knew an epoch was coming to a close, an age that had lasted more than 40 years, through war and peace, at home and abroad, all over the Atlantic world, from Williamsburg and Richmond to Philadelphia and New York and Annapolis, to Paris and London and Amsterdam, and finally to this nascent capital on the Potomac. He came to think of these decades in mythic terms. He and his colleagues, Madison, Adams, Washington, Rush, Page, and so many others now gone, as Argonauts of old. He had, he believed, done his duty. Nature intended me for the tranquil pursuits of science by rendering them my supreme delight, he wrote Pierre S. Dupont on Thursday, March 2, 1809. But the enormities of the times in which I have lived have forced me to take a part in resisting them, and to commit myself on the boisterous ocean of political passions. I leave everything in the hands of men so able to take care of them that, if we are destined to meet misfortunes, it will be because no human wisdom could avert them. He inspired as much division in his exit as he had in his election 8 years before. A few fleeting years will scarce have passed away before the men, even of the present day, casting a retrospective eye upon these times, will be seized with wonder and astonishment at the strange contrariety of opinions, the strange bickerings we have fallen into, and the unaccountable distrust that seems to exist. The Allegheny County, Maryland citizens wrote him on Monday, February 20, 1809. The distrust was real, though, and sentiment could not blunt the parting attacks of his foes. "Thou strange, inconsistent man," a New Yorker wrote in February 1809. "You have brought the government to the jaws of destruction," wrote Cassandra from Philadelphia on Tuesday, February 28. "I do not undertake to say whether by supineness, timidity, or enthusiasm. The effect is certain. On the cause I cannot pronounce." Jefferson himself was reflective and candid. In reply to a request for recommendations for which books of history to read, Jefferson suggested a long list that included Edward Gibbon, and spoke of what it felt like to make, not just read, history. "I suppose, indeed, that in public life a man whose political principles have any decided character, and who has energy enough to give them effect, must always expect to encounter political hostility from those of adverse principles," Jefferson wrote. "But I came to the government under circumstances calculated to generate peculiar acrimony. I found all its offices in the possession of a political sect who wished to transform it ultimately into the shape of their darling model, the English government." The Republican victory of 1800, Jefferson said, had blown all their designs, and they found themselves and their fortresses of power and profit put in a moment into the hands of other trustees. Lamentations and invective were all that remained to them. The target? Jefferson himself. "I became, of course, the butt of everything which reason, ridicule, malice, and falsehood could supply," he said. Still, accolades and tributes arrived regularly. From France, the U.S. consul at Paris sent Jefferson a book about Marcus Aurelius. "In the character of Marcus Aurelius, I perceive only one error. He employed no sure means to perpetuate the blessings of his reign," the consul wrote. "He seemed constantly impressed with the idea that at the moment of his extinction, the noble fabric which he sowed must infallibly sink in ruins. For this, as in every other respect, the citizens of the United States are more fortunate than the Romans, as there is every reason to believe that the benefits of the present enlightened administration will extend to other generations." The challenges endured. Jefferson constantly weighed the question of war versus embargo. "We are all politics here," he wrote Charles L. Bankhead, who had married his granddaughter Anne Carey Randolph in September 1808. "The congressional campaign is just opening," Jefferson had written Levi Lincoln in November 1808. "Three alternatives alone are to be chosen from. 1, embargo. 2, war. 3, submission and tribute. And, wonderful to tell, the last will not want advocates." There were no good choices. "Here, everything is uncertain," Jefferson wrote Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. from Washington in December. James Madison's inauguration fell on a Saturday. The day before, March 3, 1809, Samuel Harrison Smith paid tribute to the departing Jefferson in the National Intelligencer. Never will it be forgotten as long as liberty is dear to man, the paper said, that it was on this day that Thomas Jefferson retired from the supreme magistracy amid the blessings and regrets of millions. On the morning of the inaugural, Jefferson left the president's house and rode up to the Capitol to watch his beloved friend and Secretary of State take the oath as the fourth president of the United States. He and a grandson departed the mansion by themselves. Madison was being escorted along Pennsylvania Avenue in military pomp. No one on earth was closer to him politically, and Madison's success was a vindication for Jefferson, a tangible sign that the country approved of his basic vision and stewardship. After the ceremonies in the House chamber, John Quincy Adams thought the setting very magnificent. The now former president called on the new president at the Madisons on F Street. Jefferson would not move out of the president's house until a week later. Mrs. Madison looked extremely beautiful, dressed in a plain cambric dress with a very long train, all dignity, grace, and affability, said Margaret Bayard Smith. As the Madisons stood at the drawing-room door greeting the overflowing crowd of callers, the streets were crowded with carriages, and there was a half-hour's wait to get inside, Jefferson saw Margaret Bayard Smith and reached for her hand. "Remember the promise you have made me, to come see us next summer? Do not forget it," he said to Mrs. Smith, "for we shall certainly expect you." Mrs. Smith, of course, reassured him that she and her husband would come to Monticello. She then alluded to the drama of the day. "You have now resigned a heavy burden," she said to Jefferson. "Yes, indeed," he said, "and am much happier at this moment than my friend." In the swirl of the celebration, Jefferson was soon told that the ladies hoped to follow him to the president's house. Twinkling, he said, "That is right, since I am too old to follow them. I remember in France, when his friends were taking leave of Dr. Franklin, the ladies smothered him with embraces, and on his introducing me as his successor, I told him I wished he would transfer these privileges to me, but he answered, 'You are too young a man.'" That evening he joined celebrating Republicans at an inaugural ball. John Quincy Adams was unimpressed. The crowd was excessive, the heat oppressive, and the entertainment bad. At Monticello, he planned to return to farming and gardening with passionate zeal. "I am full of plans of employment when I get there," he wrote Charles Thompson, "and they chiefly respect the active functions of the body. To the mind I shall administer amusement chiefly. An only daughter and numerous family of grandchildren will furnish me great resources of happiness." He had suggested that perhaps his sister, Anne Scott Marks, could act as mistress of Monticello. Patsy hated the thought. She, no one else, was to form the core of his world. As to Aunt Marks, it would not be desirable to have her, Patsy wrote on Thursday, March 2, 1809. "I had full proof of her being totally incompetent of the business the last summer. The servants have no sort of respect for her, and take just what they please before her face. She is an excellent creature and a neat manager in a little way, but she has neither head nor a sufficient weight of character to manage so large an establishment as yours will be. I shall devote myself to it, and with feeling, which I never could have in my own affairs, and with what tenderness of affection we will wait upon and cherish you, my dearest father." As he ended his Washington days, he ordered an abridgment of John Bell's book, Principles of Surgery, sent a geranium he had cultivated and kept in the president's house to Margaret Bayard Smith, and arranged payment for 36 Windsor chairs he had ordered from Richmond for Poplar Forest, his retreat in Bedford County. Edmund Bacon had come to Washington to help pack up and move Jefferson home. The Monticello overseer was struck by the unceasing demands the Capitol made on his employer. He had a very long dining room, and his table was chock-full every one of the 16 days I was there, Bacon wrote. Bacon supervised the loading of 3 wagons with boxes and shrubbery. Bacon and his entourage set out from Washington on Thursday, March 9, 1809. Jefferson left the Capitol on Saturday, March 11, in a phaeton. There was a terrible snowstorm along the way, and Bacon prepared Jefferson's accommodations at Benjamin Shackelford's Culpeper Courthouse Tavern by ordering a large fire to be built and by fending off a drunken well-wisher eager to see the man he called Old Tom. Bacon tried to keep the crowds away from Jefferson when he arrived, but failed, and Jefferson delivered a short speech to the gathering. He was still a public man. On Wednesday, March 15, 1809, Thomas Jefferson reached Monticello. He brought the great world with him. His chef, Julian, came to set up the Monticello kitchen to prepare the French dishes Jefferson loved. His correspondence and reading were varied and voluminous. Home to stay, he was never again to stray very far from his mountaintop. His mind was another matter. It never came to rest. Part 9. The Master of Monticello, 1809 to the End. I steer my bark with hope in the head, leaving fear astern. My hopes indeed sometimes fail, but not oftener than the forebodings of the gloomy. Thomas Jefferson to John Adams. Chapter 40. My Body, Mind, and Affairs. Amidst the din of war and the wreck of nations, his wisdom has hitherto secured our peace. His eminent public services are engraved on the hearts of his children. Toast to Thomas Jefferson at Tammany Society of Washington on May 12, 1809. In his rooms at Monticello, Jefferson slept facing east on a bed built into an alcove between his working study, which was often called his cabinet, and a chamber anchored by a fireplace. Red bed curtains hung on each side of the bed. Though the rooms were peaceful, Jefferson was reminded of the passing of time by both sight and sound whenever he rested his head on his pillow. A 1790 clock, mounted between two obelisks, rested on a wooden shelf inside his sleeping alcove. With a delicate ting, it chimed the hour and the half-hour. Below the clock hung a sword, the gift, it was said, of a long-forgotten Arabian prince. And there were the sounds of Jefferson's ubiquitous mockingbirds. Overnight, the silence of the chamber was also broken, second by second, by a tall-case clock placed along the western wall of the study. The tick, tick, tick of the tall clock was constant, growing louder as the house grew quieter through the hours of darkness. When the three doors connecting Jefferson's rooms to the rest of the house were closed, they formed a surprisingly effective barrier between the master and the household. Four tall windows flanked the sleeping Jefferson in the study to his right. A single window lit the bedroom with the fireplace to his left, a room where he kept his wife's walnut dressing table. Jefferson had his own privy just steps away from his bed alcove, one of three in the house proper. He used pieces of scrap paper for hygiene purposes. Examples were collected from his privy by a family member on the day of Jefferson's death, and now survive in the Library of Congress. He generally got 5 to 8 hours of sleep a night, always reading for half an hour or an hour before bedtime using eyeglasses. As he grew older, he had difficulty hearing different voices speaking at the same time. He enjoyed good health, suffering from extremely rare fevers. The headaches that had plagued him in times of stress seemed now to have left me, once he was free of the clamor of office. His chambers were in the sun's direct path. Much of his first sense of light each morning would have come from his right, from the first easterly window in the cabinet. If he awoke, as he said he did, at early sunrise, when the hands of the obelisk clock grew visible, then there would have been a steadily rising tide of light that began as a trickle, but soon came to fill the room. Jefferson would have sat up in his alcove and turned to his left to plunge his feet into his morning basin of cold water. There he would stay for a time, looking at the fireplace and intuitively tracking the rise of the sun by the amount of light coming through the bedroom skylight. He and his Monticello were a little like the sun itself, at the center of the universe. The 11,000-square-foot, 33-room house, there are 10 other rooms in the pavilions and under the south terrace, in which he woke up every morning, was his joy. And it was only in the years after he retired from the presidency that it was exactly as he wished it to be. Walking into the entrance hall by the glass front door on the east front of Monticello, Jefferson, his family, and his guests were immediately immersed in the work of his life. Artifacts and emblems of America's natural and political worlds hung in the great hall. The floor was green, at the suggestion of Gilbert Stuart, the walls whitewashed with a yellow-orange dado below the chair rail. There were antlers of moose and elk, the upper jawbone of a mastodon, and 40 Indian objects, including carved stone sculptures, tools, a Mandan buffalo robe, and a small portrait of a young Sac chief. There were maps, including the Fry Jefferson map of Virginia, drawn by his father so long before, and later ones of North America, Europe, Africa, and Asia. There was a scale model of the Pyramid of Cheops. There was a sculpture, Ariadne, which Jefferson long mistook for one of Cleopatra before realizing the work was a depiction of the tragic mythological heroine. There were the paintings St. Jerome in Meditation and Jesus in the Praetorium, which Jefferson described in detail. Jesus stripped of the purple, as yet naked, and with the crown of thorns on his head. He is sitting. The persons present seem to be one of his revilers, one of his followers, and the superintendent of the execution, the subject from Mark 15:16-20. There were portraits of America's Vespucius, John Adams, and of Jefferson himself by Gilbert Stuart. Two engravings of the Declaration of Independence, one of John Trumbull's depiction of the signing, the other of the document itself, and busts of Hamilton, Voltaire, and Turgot, the French politician and economist. There was method to the decoration of Monticello. For Jefferson, the portraits, busts, statues, and artifacts in the house were not a random collection, but rather memorials of those worthies whose remembrance I feel a pride and comfort in consecrating there. Anything, or anyone, represented within Monticello was meaningful to Jefferson in some way and to some degree. Only steps into the house, then, the range of Jefferson's mind and heart, the universal nature of his interests, and his sense of the sweep of history, were manifest to every eye. The fossils and antlers, the Indian artifacts, and the maps represented the primeval American world and the white man's first attempts to project power over the land. The Pyramid and Ariadne were refugees from the ancient world. The paintings of St. Jerome and of Jesus in the moments before the crucifixion commemorated the vast and inarguable role of religion in the history of Western civilization. Vespucius and Columbus, whose portrait hung in the next room, the parlor, carried the story across the Atlantic to the New World. Voltaire and Turgot represented the work of the philosophers of the Enlightenment. Adams, Hamilton, Jefferson himself, and the Continental Congress in declaring independence for Britain brought the tale forward into the recent past, into the work of the master of the house's lifetime. And so it goes. Room after room, object after object, engraving after engraving, painting after painting, medallion after medallion, throughout Monticello. To reach the parlor, guests moved beneath the tall ceiling decorated with a plaster relief of an eagle surrounded by stars, across the floor and under a brass Argand-style lamp, and a balcony to cross onto a beautiful floor of cherry and beech, a parquet pattern Jefferson personally designed. Like the hall, the parlor is 18 feet 2 inches high and decorated with a Corinthian frieze from the temple of Jupiter the Thunderer. Here, Jefferson crafted a room of tiered artwork, surrounding card tables, chairs, sofas, a chess set, a harpsichord, and a pianoforte, a room in which the present life of the house and of the family unfolded in the midst of emblems of the past that had made its owner and its owner's nation possible. Portraits, 24. Paintings, 17. Medals, 10. Busts, 2. Miscellaneous, 4, Jefferson wrote, cataloging the parlor's decorations. Here hung paintings and here sat sculptures of the makers of the age and of the ages. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Magellan, Napoleon, Lafayette, Columbus, Vespucius, Alexander I, David Rittenhouse, Sir Walter Raleigh, James Madison, Thomas Paine, James Monroe, Louis XVI, John Locke, Sir Isaac Newton, Francis Bacon, Adams and Jefferson himself, both by Trumbull and by Mather Brown. There was an elegant Charles Wilson Peale portrait of Jefferson's grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, and a medallion of Edward Preble, who triumphed at Tripoli in 1804. As in the hall, there were religious images, too. The penitent Magdalene, descent from the cross, and Herodias bearing the head of St. John the Baptist. Two small Sevres figures, Venus with Cupid and Hope with Cupid, evoked the ancient world. The brilliantly yellow dining room sits to the right. Through it, separated by double pocket doors on rollers, is the small octagonal tea room. There, Jefferson and his family would eat and converse in what he called his most honorable suite, glancing up at busts of Washington, Franklin, Lafayette, and John Paul Jones, all plaster copies of works by Jean-Antoine Houdon. Patsy had a blue sitting room near her father's private rooms called the South Square Room, and there was a north octagonal room with an alcove bed often used by Dolly and James Madison when they visited. The upstairs, including the beautiful dome room atop the house, was a series of small bedrooms. The center of the house and the center of life was downstairs, where Jefferson presided. If it had not been called Monticello, a visitor wrote in 1816, I would call it Olympus, and Jove its occupant. Jefferson's family agreed. His cheerfulness and affection, a granddaughter recalled, were the warm sun in which his family all basked and were invigorated. He was like a patriarch of old, as he put it in a letter to Maria Cosway. Our mother educated all her children to look up to her father as she looked up to him herself, literally looked up, as to one standing on an eminence of greatness and goodness, wrote a granddaughter, Ellen Coolidge. And it is no small proof of his real elevation that as we grew older and better able to judge for ourselves, we were more and more confirmed in the opinions we had formed of it. His grandchildren loved him and revered him. They followed him on garden walks, never, though, putting a foot on a garden bed, for that would violate one of his rules. He never had to raise his voice. Their sense of his authority was so complete that it was unnecessary for him to utter a harsh word to one of us, or speak in a raised tone of voice, or use a threat, a granddaughter recalled. He simply said, do, or do not, and that was that. He picked fruit for them, usually figs and cherries, with a long stick topped with a hook and a net bag, and he organized and presided over races on the grounds. The course was the terrace or around the lawn. Jefferson gave head starts according to ages, and the contestants took off when he dropped his white handkerchief from his outstretched right hand. Awards were 3 figs, prunes, or dates for the winner, 2 for second place, and 1 for third. On some summer nights, he had a chess table of his own design, it had been made by John Hemmings, set up outside for matches with a granddaughter. In the wintertime, when the days were short, Jefferson would sit with his family before a fire in the late afternoon. This was the hour, a granddaughter said, when it grew too dark to read, and so, in the half hour before candles came in, as we all sat round the fire, he taught us several childish games, and would play them with us. There was cross questions and crooked answers, and I love my love with a pastime in which successive players had to come up with attributes throughout the alphabet. The arrival of candles signaled an end to games and a resumption of reading. Everything fell quiet as Jefferson took up his book to read, and we would not speak out of a whisper lest we should disturb him, and generally we followed his example and took a book. And I've seen him raise his eyes from his own book and look round on the little circle of readers and smile and make some remark to Mama about it. To preserve the privacy of his rooms, he had constructed Venetian porches or porticles with blinds that shielded the visibility of his quarters from outside the main house. Still, he did not like being alone for any great length of time. Once, when he was snowed in at Poplar Forest, he wrote Patsy, I am like a state prisoner. My keepers set before me at fixed hours something to eat and withdraw. His command was total, his love enveloping. On journeys to Bedford, he took care to wrap his family in capes and, if needed, furs. He sang and conversed the whole way and served picnic lunches of cold meat and wine mixed with water. He once overheard a young granddaughter lament that she had never had a silk dress. One arrived for her from Charlottesville the next day. On another occasion, a granddaughter tore a beloved muslin dress on the glass door connecting the hall to the portico. Grandpapa was standing by and saw the disaster, the granddaughter recalled. Several days later, the former president of the United States came into Patsy's sitting room adjacent to his own apartment, a bundle in his hand. To his granddaughter, he said, "I've been mending your dress for you." It was a new frock. He might hear a child express a wish for a watch, or for a saddle and bridle, or for a guitar, and would quietly provide them, doing so with borrowed money. He made sure his grandchildren were given Bibles and Shakespeare and writing tables. Our grandfather seemed to read our hearts, to see our invisible wishes, to be our good genius, to wave the fairy wand, to brighten our young lives by his goodness and his gifts. His sense of the needs of others was part of his nature, a nature, one granddaughter said, so eminently sympathetic that with those he loved, he could enter into their feelings, anticipate their wishes, gratify their tastes, and surround them with an atmosphere of affection. A patriarch's love is rather like a politician's skill. Both are about perceiving what others want and trying, within reason, to provide it. That had been the work of Jefferson's public life, and now, in retirement, it was that of his personal life, too. The good cheer Margaret Bayard Smith had noted in Jefferson at Madison's inauguration remained evident in the first months of his return to Virginia. "Mr. Jefferson called last week and dined here yesterday," Elizabeth Trist wrote a friend from Farmington in April 1809. "I never saw him look better nor appear so happy." On her own promised visit to Monticello in the middle of 1809, Margaret Bayard Smith thought Jefferson in a perfect place and frame of mind. "The sun never sees him in bed, and his mind designs more than the day can fulfill, even his long day," she wrote. "There is a tranquility about him, which an inward peace could alone bestow." As he began his retirement, Jefferson enjoyed reading of the public's confidence in him and the course he had set. "We have been permitted to hear the thunder of war at a distance, and peaceably tread the arduous path of intellectual improvement, unmolested by the awful din of battle, or the more dreadful scenes of devastation that now desolate the nations of the world," a group of college students wrote on Inauguration Day, 1809. An anonymous writer praised him as the greatest of men. "You have, in your public capacity, been to me a father, a protector, a preserver. For these services I will forever render you the tribute of a grateful heart." An old friend from France offered him the highest flattery. "Though I am convinced that Mr. Madison, your friend and your student, will govern according to the same principles as you have, I cannot help regretting that you did not want to retain the presidency for 4 more years. Pierre Samuel Dupont de Nemours wrote Jefferson in June 1809. The world still looked to him and to America as emblems of hope. "No one knows better than you how difficult it is to do good. Men are very evil. Their heads are filled with nonsense, and it is so contagious, so tenacious, that not even the great philosophical chemist Jefferson is able to reduce it to gas so that it evaporates from human judgment," wrote a Spanish diplomat at Philadelphia. "What would become of mankind if republican government did not survive in your country?" asked a French correspondent. "I shudder to think of the consequences." In his cabinet, he wrote with his legs stretched out along a red leather bench beneath a plantation writing table. A fully engaged farmer, he grudgingly spent hours at his table, reading and keeping up with his correspondence. "My present course of life admits less reading than I wish," Jefferson wrote Benjamin Rush from Monticello. From breakfast or noon at latest to dinner, I am mostly on horseback, attending to my farms or other concerns, which I find helpful to my body, mind, and affairs. He ordered samplings of the English mulberry and peach apricot, as well as wild geese, and a ram for the farm. I am now on horseback among my farms from an early breakfast to a late dinner, with little regard to weather, he told Lafayette in January 1811. I find it gives health to body, mind, and affairs. He had a ready refrain on the subject of politics. I feel a much greater interest in knowing what has passed 2 or 3,000 years ago than in what is now passing, he wrote in 1819. I read nothing, therefore, but of the heroes of Troy, of Pompey and Caesar, and of Augustus, too. Yet Jefferson could never fully remove himself from the life of the present. To Lafayette he expressed the hope that the tumults of Europe would work themselves out. If there be a God, and he is just, his day will come. He will never abandon the whole race of man to be eaten up by the leviathans and mammoths of a day. He subscribed to the papers, telling Madison that he was reading the newspapers but little, and that little but as the romance of the day. A word of truth now and then comes like a drop of water on the tongues of Dives. One thing was very clear as he settled back into life on the mountain. He loved, he said, the ineffable luxury of being owner of my own time. With those hours, he stayed in close touch with the scientific, educational, and philosophical worlds. William Clark continued to dispatch specimens to the president's house, and Madison sent the skin of a bighorn sheep from the Rocky Mountains to Monticello on July 4, 1809. The bundle being too large for the mail, I shall forward it by some other opportunity. Jefferson oversaw the English translation of a French commentary on Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws, debated the origins of the potato with the correspondent, wrote for vine cuttings to cultivate wine, and mused on the role of libraries. I have often thought that nothing would do more extensive good at small expense than the establishment of a small circulating library in every county, to consist of a few well-chosen books, to be lent to the people of the county under such regulations as would secure their safe return in due time, he said. In the fall, John Walker, his one-time friend, whose wife Jefferson had tried to woo, was sick, and said that he would like to see his old friend. James Monroe wrote Jefferson to tell him, "A visit by you to Colonel Walker would at this time be considered by him an act of great kindness, and be received with much sensibility." Betsy Walker was ill, too. Apparently unwilling to risk a scene, Jefferson decided not to pay the call at Belvoir, declining to make the short journey he had so often made in that distant summer during his bachelor days. He sent a gift of a basket of ripe figs, prompting Hugh Nelson, a Walker son-in-law, to thank him and report the sad news that both Walkers were still very feeble and low. He was also forever prepared to refight the years of his governorship. Writing a historian seeking information on the revolutionary period, he argued that Virginia had always contributed above par to the national efforts. Indeed, he said, "Our whole occupation was in straining the resources of the state to their utmost, to furnish men, money, provisions, and other necessaries to the common cause." Word arrived of the brutal death of his old secretary, Meriwether Lewis, while traveling through Tennessee. As Jefferson heard the story, the sleeping wife of the man who kept the inn where Lewis was staying had heard two pistol shots. Lewis, who had been thought deranged, was found weltering in his blood with a wound to his head and a fatal shot to the heart. The first had apparently failed to kill him, and he tried to finish the job with the second. This, too, seemed to have been insufficient, and the poor man was left to stab himself with his dirk. Elijah Fletcher, a visitor from Vermont, left an unsparing account of Jefferson. "Mr. Jefferson is tall, spare, straight in body," Fletcher wrote in 1811. "His face not handsome, but savage. I learnt he was but little esteemed by his neighbors. The story of Black Sal is no farce. That he cohabits with her and has a number of children by her is a sacred truth. And the worst of it is, he keeps the same children slaves. An unnatural crime, which is very common in these parts. This conduct may receive a little palliation when we consider that such proceedings are so common that they cease here to be disgraceful. Jefferson coolly recorded the births of Hemings' children in his farm book, along with other details of the lives of his slaves and of the fates of his crops. He was apparently able to consign his children with Sally Hemings to a separate sphere of life in his mind, even as they grew up in his midst. "He was not in the habit of showing partiality or fatherly affection to us children," said Madison Hemings, who added that Jefferson was, however, affectionate toward his white grandchildren. It was, to say the least, an odd way to live, but Jefferson was a creature of his culture. The enjoyment of a Negro or mulatto woman is spoken of as quite a common thing. No reluctance, delicacy, or shame is made about the matter, Josiah Quincy, Jr. of Massachusetts, wrote after a visit to the Carolinas. It is far from being uncommon to see a gentleman at dinner, and his reputed offspring a slave to the master of the table. This was the daily reality at Monticello. In a letter to fellow biographer James Parton, Henry Randall reported some observations of Thomas Jefferson Randolph's From the Mountain. Discussing the physical similarities between Jefferson and the children of Sally Hemings, Randolph said in one case that the resemblance was so close that at some distance, or in the dusk, the slave, dressed in the same way, might be mistaken for Mr. Jefferson. On one occasion, Randolph reported, "A gentleman dining with Mr. Jefferson looked so startled as he raised his eyes from the latter to the servant behind him that his discovery of the resemblance was perfectly obvious to all." Randolph offered these reminiscences to support the theory that Jefferson's nephew Peter Carr was the father of Sally Hemings' children, a theory ultimately disproved by DNA research. For Jefferson, such ambiguities and unacknowledged truths were part of life. "I asked Colonel Randolph why on earth Mr. Jefferson did not put these slaves, who looked like him, out of the public sight by sending them to his Bedford estate or elsewhere," Randall wrote Parton. He said, "Mr. Jefferson never betrayed the least consciousness of the resemblance, and although he, Colonel Randolph, had no doubt his mother would have been very glad to have them removed, that both and all venerated Mr. Jefferson too deeply to broach such a topic to him. What suited him satisfied them." What suited Jefferson was the code of denial that defined life in the slave-owning states. It was his plantation, his world,